This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at RightsCast.net.
Hey folks, it's RightsCast Network founder R.R. Campbell here, and if you've visited my site or the site for the RightsCast Network or any of my social media profiles before, you've likely noticed scores of high-quality images of my books in a number of picturesque settings. This might have had you wondering who exactly I paid to take those photos, how much it might have cost to pay a professional photographer to offer this service, and is what I paid possibly worth it? Well, I'm going to let you in on a secret. I didn't hire a professional photographer at all. No, I used a software called Mockup Shots. Yes, Mockup Shots is an online software by Adazing that lets you upload your book covers to create high-quality images of your books for publicity purposes. Using Mockup Shots has saved me tons of time, and it's helped me further develop my brand and sharpen my web presence. And if you're interested in saving time and having some really sharp images of your book available at the snap of a finger, you can visit bit.ly/bookcoverphotos to get yourself Mockup Shots today. And Mockup Shots comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you're not satisfied, you can get your money back. Again, the site to visit is bit.ly/bookcoverphotos. YouTube is a treasure trove of DIY content, music streaming, and, of course, cat videos. But for many writers, YouTube is so much more. In fact, the online writing community is so prevalent on YouTube that its corner of the YouTube world is known colloquially as AuthorTube. And for this episode, I'm interviewing one of the stars of AuthorTube, who joined me to discuss what YouTube can offer writers in the form of writerly education and platform building. Hey there, I'm International Book Awards finalist, writing coach, and RightsCast Network founder R.R. Campbell, and welcome to episode 89 of your listener-supported R.R. Campbell RightsCast here on the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. For this episode, I'm joined by Meg Latour. Meg is a best-selling science fiction and fantasy author, a YouTube darling, and the founder of iWriterly, the creator of the free query critique platform Query Hack, a co-host of The Publishable Show, and so much more. Formerly, Meg worked at a literary agency, and she has a background in magazine publishing, medical and technical writing, and journalism. Clearly, Meg's depth of breadth and experience in all things bookish makes her the perfect candidate to talk all things YouTube with us, and I was thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with her. But before we get to my conversation with Meg Latour, however, I want to touch base again on the goings-on in the querying trenches, on the feedback one might receive there or elsewhere, and how drilling deeper into that feedback might help us better understand ourselves, our readers, and open opportunities for new ways forward, even in the face of rejection. If you'll recall, at the start of August in episode 87 with Amanda Ziba, we explored how we can better frame our personal querying statistics such that they encourage us to keep up the good fight, rather than to cower beneath the ridge of the querying trench we've dug for ourselves. Back in that episode, I shared I had a full request for my Northern Wisconsin Cranberry Farm manuscript still up in the air. I was thrilled about this request from my number one, tippy-top-of-the-list dream agent, but I didn't expect to hear anything from them for a few months. Then, just this last week, an email hit my inbox. "Thanks so much for allowing me to review your manuscript. On a line level, your writing is, capital letters, exactly, and capital letters, the kind I salivate over, and I found it ridiculously easy to fall in love with your two main characters." Now, this, listeners, it should go without saying that this, yes, this is how we want an email from an agent who has requested a full manuscript to begin. Perhaps you're feeling it now too, as you drive in your car or wash your dishes or pass the time listening to this podcast at your day job. There's an inching forward in one's chair, the sudden awareness of the flushness of one's cheeks, the air stiflingly pregnant with possibility and promise. Of course, the email continues. Ultimately, however, I feel like the tension had mostly worn away at around a quarter of the way through, which didn't push me to keep reading. And there, as longtime Green Bay Packers announcer Wayne Larrivee might say, is your dagger. But you know this pain, listener. You know what it is to have loved and lost in life and in art. This is the ecstasy and the agony about which one writes, the moments that fuel our approach to the page. In this, then, a rejection of this nature, or any nature really, is not an end, but an opportunity for a new beginning, which is precisely why I want to examine how we, as writers, ought to focus, yes, on the specifics of the feedback we receive, but also on the opportunities any feedback received presents for us and for our work going forward. Now, I'll admit, it was a surprise for me to read that, in the view of this agent, the tension had mostly worn away about a quarter of the way through the manuscript they reviewed. When the Stars Conspire, as this manuscript is currently known, takes after much of my other work. The scenes are structured such that every one of them has a clear goal, conflict, resolution, and cliffhanger, or pivot point, or change moment, and it's this structure that has had readers of my published work emailing me to let me know they stayed up well past their bedtime to finish a book like Accounting for It All, which isn't, I imagine, anyone's definition of your traditional spellbinding suspense novel. In fact, this scene structure system is the same one I used in Imminent Dawn, which, as listeners to last week's episode know, was recently named as an International Book Awards finalist. So what gives? Have I misjudged the utility of this scene structure system? Am I a fraud? Or is this agent just wrong? Well, I'll stop myself there, and I encourage you to do similarly if you ever find yourself framing feedback as all or nothing or dismissing feedback received so blatantly out of hand. Writing creatively is a highly personal endeavor, and when we write from a personal place, it only stands to reason that disagreements over what our words mean or whether they're effective can come across as attacks on the self. But that's not it. That's not where our focus should rest. Instead, we need to dig deeper. We need to, as is often the case with our characters, get to the why. What's motivated a comment like this to wind up in the margins of our pages or be sent to us by email? Well, in my case, it took a day or two of quiet contemplation, but I think I sussed it out. You see, there is tension in When the Stars Conspire, and it's present throughout. Unlike Accounting for It All and Imminent Dawn, however, much of the tension comes in the form of mystery rather than suspense. And using this logic, I can reach two more nuanced conclusions. Either one, the mystery that's on the page is not as gripping as I and beta readers have believed it to be, or two, this agent is more engaged by suspense and/or dramatic irony than they are by mystery. Or, alternatively, both. What if the mystery does come up short and this agent simply happens to prefer tension in the form of suspense and dramatic irony? All of this is possible, but it's only possible if we reject the notion of either-or, if we separate the personal from the professional, and if we give ourselves space to drill deep down into the why of any feedback we receive. Particularly when we can't go directly to the source for clarification about the motivation behind the critique. And I'll say this, writer folk, no matter the nuance behind this particular rejection, I'm happy I've at least tried to better understand it. Because now, more than ever, I'm in a better position to evaluate my own work and that of others in my capacity as a writing coach. And perhaps more excitingly, I'm far more eager to return to the querying trenches than I was a few weeks ago. Why? Well, let me share with you how this particular rejection email ended. I'm sorry I wasn't the perfect fit on this one, but think you're an excellent writer and would love to see your next project when you have it ready. And folks, if you know anything about me, you know I've always got another project at the ready. Thanks for listening to this episode's preamble. If my words during it have struck a chord with you, I'd love it if you would let me know by email at writescast@gmail.com or on Twitter and Instagram as @writescast. Alternatively, you can reach me via my author accounts on social media where I can be found as @IamRRCampbell. Tell me how querying is going for you. How are you processing the feedback you've received from your beta readers? Are you seeing it differently now after tuning into this episode? Let me know. I'd love to feature your comments in future episodes. And if you want to learn more about my approach to scene structure, you can tune into episode 13 from way back in 2017, in which I spend an entire episode explaining the goal, conflict, resolution, cliffhanger chain. That episode is a little out of date by now. There's more to be said about scene structure than I could capture in that single episode, but I think it covers the basics well. And if you want to develop a deeper understanding of mystery, suspense, and dramatic irony, check out episode 40, during which I interviewed Tim Storm about these three dimensions to tension. All right, I don't know about you, but I'm ready for Meglator. So without further ado, let's hop into my conversation with Meg, the best-selling science fiction and fantasy author and the founder of iWriterly. Stay tuned after the interview for more about what you can expect next from the RightsCast Network, and thanks, as always, for listening. Thank you so much, Meg Latour, for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell RightsCast.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We are, of course, now in Social Media Month on the RightsCast Network, and we are kicking off Social Media Month by talking about YouTube. So to get started, why don't you describe for us what led you to creating the iWriterly channel and what made YouTube an attractive option for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So unconventional answer, I did not mean to become a YouTuber. Yeah. Originally back in 2016, I'd been working at a literary agency and writing a lot of guest blogs for publications like Writer's Digest and Savvy Authors. And over time, I realized that the content wasn't connecting with people in the way that I'd hoped. In other words, people don't really read blogs anymore. At least that's what I have found in my experience. And so I'd been writing these blogs because I had been seeing a lot of aspiring authors make the same mistakes when querying. And I wanted to find a way to help them avoid these mistakes and have a quicker learning curve. So my husband was actually the one who recommended I give YouTube a try. He was an avid watcher of YouTube at that time, and I was not. I am now, but I wasn't then. But he convinced me that this would be a great way to connect with more authors and help to achieve my goal of educating. And then over time, I discovered there were two communities on YouTube, BookTube and AuthorTube. And I dabbled in both types of content before jumping fully into like writing and publishing how-tos, which is more like the AuthorTube side of things. So for me, doing this whole YouTube thing was sort of an accident, but I would say that some of the appeals to having an AuthorTube channel or YouTube channel in general would be the ability to brand yourself as an author, grow your platform in a more personal way, and connect more deeply with an audience. There's something about an audience seeing your face and how you talk. It makes a deeper, more personal connection. And then if you grow your audience enough, it's also a way to practice something like public speaking. And a lot of authors do public speaking as a form of income and growing their brand.
Yeah, it seems like there is, of course, a lot of utility in getting involved with YouTube, whether that is as a learner or as a content producer. And we will certainly get into that really hard here coming up in a couple of minutes. But I want to reflect for a moment on your story to becoming a YouTuber, because it actually reminded me a bit of what got me into the world of podcasting. I had for a long time been doing blogging here or there, never found like a lot of traction. As you say, it seemed that people weren't really reading blogs. And then one afternoon, after a writing group that I was a part of, someone approached me and said, "Hey, have you ever considered starting a podcast?" And I had not. I was an avid podcast listener, but I was like, I don't know, am I going to start a podcast? What would that be like? What would I talk about, kind of thing? And then similar to you, I just got involved and listened to some more content that was podcast related in the world of writing and books and said, hey, maybe I'll give this a shot. And there you have it. So folks, look, you can see a nice pattern here. This is one way to get involved, right? So whether it's YouTube, whether it's podcasting, you have some options there. So Meg, you know, a lot of people might first think of Twitter or their local library or their nearby university as places where they might learn more about writing. But why should listeners to this show consider using YouTube to help them grow as writers?
I think the first and biggest reason is that it's free. So unlike a university degree or an online course, YouTube is completely free. It's also convenient since you can watch it anywhere if you have a device connected to Wi-Fi. So that's the first big reason in my book. There's no barrier to entry. Anyone can learn if they have a mind to. As for Twitter, because I do have my roots in Twitter, that's where the publishing industry is most active. Traditional publishing industry is most active. And that's where I was most active when I was at the literary agency. So there is value to being on Twitter. But I do think that, I don't think that it's the same when it comes to teaching. Specifically, YouTube is usually long form content, and that content can be education, inspiration, entertainment, or maybe all three if you play your cards right. But YouTube is also a visual and audio medium. So some people learn through reading, say like a book through a library, while other people need to listen to someone else teach them something. And I think it will depend on how you learned for what medium you want to learn from. But I do think that the long form content content on YouTube is one of the biggest appeals to educating yourself through that platform.
And I think something that listeners might consider as well, whether it is in the realm of YouTube or even listening to a podcast, if we were to contrast those methods of learning with like taking a course at a university or doing a lot of reading online or doing reading from how-to books, etc., platforms like YouTube and getting into the world of podcasting are, to some extent, passive media. It's the sort of thing that you can play in the background and you can always at least be in YouTube. You can be listening to that content and still be learning while you're doing other things. And so I think that is something that I personally really enjoy about YouTube, whether it is learning something writerly, whether it is learning about a book, whether I am watching, quote unquote, watching some sort of DIY about how to do something on a website, or even just learning more about Dungeons and Dragons, I don't necessarily have to watch the video. I can let it play in the background and be picking up that information passively. And so that personally is something I really love about YouTube. I don't know if that is that a way that you found yourself using YouTube in the past?
Absolutely. I found that over time, I just don't have time to sit down and watch YouTube stuff. So I'll usually like put my earpods in or AirPods. I always say it wrong. I put them in. And as I'm like doing dishes or working around the house, that, you know, that I don't need my full attention to do that task, I totally listen to YouTube videos and learn something. It's like constant education, and you don't have to even be watching the YouTube videos to get the content. Same thing with podcasts. You know, you just listen, unless it's like a video podcast.
Right. It's that this idea of this free content and it's passive media. So folks, the world really is your oyster. So with all that in mind, though, let's say you're a listener to this show or someone who has watched the iWriterly channel in the past, and they've wanted to start a YouTube channel of their own, but you're not really sure where to start. So Meg, what is it that one might consider addressing or considering before recording and uploading one's first video?
I recommend watching YouTube a lot before you start recording. Specifically, watch creators in the niche you want to create videos in, such as like BookTube or AuthorTube, and see what kind of content they create, what they do, and essentially what's expected by the audience out of those videos so that you can learn not just what they expect, but then how to stand out. And I also recommend watching YouTube channels where the creators teach about how to succeed on YouTube, not just like, you know, folks in your own niche. So Think Media and Think Marketing are probably two of my favorite channels for learning how to YouTube. That way you understand things like how to rank videos, how to title your videos, what types of thumbnails to make, how to structure your videos, and so on. And last, remember that content is king. It doesn't matter if you're recording on your smartphone or if you have bad lighting. As long as you have good content that's providing value to an audience and that audience can hear you, which yes, usually means you have to invest in a microphone up front. That's really what matters.
And what that really reminds me of, this idea of watching before you start recording, getting familiar with what's doing well and what might work, is it's an awful lot to me like preparing for the querying process or preparing to write a manuscript. One thing that I know you are very familiar with is this idea of comparison titles. And if we're to make sure that we are bringing in to our queries really solid comparison titles, well, we have to be well read in the genres in which we want to write or are currently writing or plan on querying. And so it seems like, again, there's this nice synergy, I guess, between all of these different processes, and that, hey, you kind of want to do your research before you do something like I did, Meg, which was decide a couple of months ago to haphazardly hop on YouTube and just start uploading videos with no real plan at all and hoping that if you plot it, they will come. And as is the case in the world of books as well, just because you publish it doesn't mean they come. You've got to do that research and have a plan going into it. At least that's my experience anyway.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty accurate. And it's a really interesting parallel, but it's true. You have to kind of learn what is typical in your genre for books or in your niche for YouTube, so that way you can learn how to stand out. So very true.
And I think it's really great that you've pointed out as well that it is about so much more than engaging with the kind of content that we want to create, but also that there is this sort of meta that we can get into as well with these channels like Think Media and Think Marketing that you have recommended that will give you this sort of the behind the curtain look at YouTube and what it is that YouTube and perhaps its algorithms are looking to put out there in the world and how viewers actually interact with content once they're on the site. Because here's the parallel that we have. It's like trying to game Amazon, so to speak, if you're an indie publisher, and making sure that you put your stuff in the right genres and attach the right keywords to it. All of this is so important, and these parallels are, well, they're popping out to me right and left anyway.
Yes, I know, absolutely. Because if you, discoverability is key, right? So if you publish a book on Amazon, you want to be discovered in Amazon's algorithm. So you kind of have to play to their rules and do all the things correctly. Now, YouTube has its own algorithm too. And so you have to play to their rules to learn how to do things like rank videos. So if you type in how to write a book, which is really competitive, probably don't want to use that one. But ideally, one of your videos will be one of the top ones to show up, and then that helps with discoverability. But again, you have to play to the rules in order to be discovered.
Right. And then, of course, once we've recorded our first few videos, we've put in all of the groundwork, and we're getting our content out into the world, how is it that we can maintain momentum? Because I have to imagine that is something that can be a challenge, particularly if we're not seeing the kind of viewership that we might have been looking for. So what is it that we can do to maintain that momentum and from there grow our channel?
Absolutely. As I mentioned in the previous question, I recommend trying to learn from YouTube experts on how to succeed on YouTube, because there are completely different strategies for how to rank videos or go viral on YouTube versus just uploading and posting. So before YouTubers worry about gaining momentum, I recommend to first make a ton of content to see what type of content that you like to make. For example, I started out my channel dabbling in BookTube content, and I quickly learned that wasn't for me. I didn't like doing it. And then I've seen other YouTubers start in the AuthorTube space, see that wasn't for them, and then made videos in a different niche. So I recommend trying lots of different types of content until you find what works for you and what your audience enjoys. It's like this kind of balance. But one of the biggest hindrances to creators on YouTube is that they will often create videos for themselves rather than for an audience. For example, maybe you vlog about your day. To you, that might be a fun video to create, but for an audience that doesn't know you, they probably aren't going to really care about watching you go about your day. Instead, make videos that entertain, educate, or inspire your audience. Answer a question for them. That way, you're providing value and they want to come back. Another tip is to niche down. You cannot be everything to everyone. So if you're making videos about writing books, doing travel vlogs, talking about nutrition, and maybe doing a few gardening videos, that's four different niches that are too different, and you can't nail down a single audience. Essentially, it's what I'm saying, niche, you basically have one audience that is interested in one niche. So instead, pick one thing and become the expert in that one thing on one channel. If you want to make videos on other topics, make other YouTube channels, but essentially YouTube won't know who to recommend your videos to and their algorithm if you don't niche down and really target your ideal audience, just like authors would do for their novels. So once you've done all this, then I recommend learning how to rank videos. So once you've laid your foundation, then worry about playing the algorithm. And that's like the best and easiest way to be discovered once you've got a firm foundation on YouTube to rank videos, because the algorithm isn't going to pick you up at first, and you're not going to be recommended to people on like their homepage or in up next in the video. Watch next section under the video that you're watching. That takes a while to get there. So first you have to rank videos.
So what I'm picking up on here again is this parallel is going to be the word of this episode. I swear, it seems we're just converging on parallel after parallel here. This idea that, just like you said in that answer, who is our target audience? We have to know who that is for our books, and we have to know who that's going to be over on YouTube. You know, if you were to be at a writing conference and pitch an agent and they ask you, well, who is this book for? There is, I feel, a tendency among some beginning writers to say, well, I think it could be for everyone, because you want to say, hey, look, there's going to be a huge audience. But if we just say everyone, well, then maybe we're starting a YouTube channel like, I don't know, someone named R.R. Campbell, who feels he's going to do a pseudo vlog and release it every week. And if you plot it again, they will come. And as we have seen, that does not turn out to be the case. And just beyond that, I mean, the other thing that's really standing out to me here is this idea of perseverance. When you talk about in the world of publishing, it is such a long game. You know, you don't write a manuscript in a day. You don't get it published the next day. The book isn't in your hand, you know, 2 weeks after that, whatever the case might be. You have to persevere with your writing. You have to persevere, it seems, with a YouTube channel as well. At least that's my takeaway from all of this anyway.
Absolutely. Just for reference for the viewers listening to this, if you're really interested in getting on YouTube, I was on YouTube for 2.5 years consistently uploading videos every single week before my channel took off. So it is a marathon and not a sprint. You can't expect to post videos for 2 months and be like, where are all my followers? Why aren't they here? They're not there because it's a long game. It's really a slow build. But once you get that first wave of growth, I think I grew from 3,000 subscribers to 33,000 subscribers in a single year. And since then, that was through December 2019. And then now January 2020 to now, I went from 33 and I think I'm at about 70,000 subscribers. So once that those first waves hit, if you learn how to keep them going, you can grow much faster. But it is a long game, I think, just like publishing books. Since apparently, yeah, this episode is all about parallels.
Whether it's publishing books, a YouTube channel, or even starting a small business, you know, they say that first $100 is the hardest to earn. The first, the first thousand's hard. That first, whatever your benchmark is going to be. And then after that, you can get that sort of snowball effect. The algorithm starts to smile upon you. Word of mouth helps out. Social media kind of feeds into itself. And then there you have it. You go from 3,000 to almost 70,000 subscribers now. And that is staggering and really impressive success. So Meg, congrats to you for hanging in there, because it seems like that's the big lesson that we need to take away from that.
Yeah, no, I think it is all about perseverance. And it's actually really interesting, because I was thinking about stopping YouTube shortly before things took off. I was kind of like, well, I've been at this for 2 years and you know, it takes a lot of time and all these different things. But yeah, it really is a lot about perseverance and thinking about what it is you want. Like, what do you want out of the social media channels? What do you want out of YouTube? What are your goals? How does it line up with your vision for your future? How does it line up with your books and so forth?
Leaves crunch underfoot. The sky grays and a cozy chill sets in. Like it or not, fall will soon be upon us, but never fear. The savior of the season is here in the form of Chosen One, the first ever seasonal candle from Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. Chosen One is infused with pumpkin spice and hints of custard, maple, and brown sugar, which induce a sweet solace we would be lucky to savor year-round. So settle in with your latte and draw your manuscript near. Tis the season for coziness, wordcraft, and candle burning. But act soon. Kill Your Darlings Candle Company is only making 50 Chosen Ones, and they're expected to sell out long before the first leaves have fallen. So to place your order, visit kydcandleco.com. That's kydcandleco.com. Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. Candles for the wordsmiths of the world.
And that kind of makes me think about that expression of how it's always darkest before the dawn. You know, you have that moment where you're thinking, I don't know, is YouTube going to be worth it? And then there you are suddenly with that first big wave of new subscribers coming in. And I can say from personal experience, and listeners, I promise you this is true, there have been times where I have looked at my writing, where I have looked at things like book sales, and I've thought to myself, I don't know. I just don't know. I'm not really feeling it. Maybe it's time for me to kind of shift gears, transition back into the corporatocracy, which I do not want to do, but I have this thought. And then oftentimes I found that after I have that thought, within a week, there have been times where I'm suddenly offered another publishing contract.
Yes.
So, right. It's just hang in there. Sometimes when you have that creeping feeling that you're not putting in the work or that the work's not paying off, that success is just around the corner. And that actually kind of brings me into our next question here, Meg. And that's this idea that let's say we've done everything that you've recommended thus far with our channel, but we're struggling to break through. What is it that we can do to help ourselves feel as though our channel is still bringing value to the community, even if we're not seeing it in an increase in subscribers or viewership?
Yeah, I hinted at this a little bit before, but think about why you're making videos. Is it just to grow an audience? In my opinion, that reason is okay, but there needs to be something else to keep you going when things get tough. For me, it was to educate others. For others, it might be to document their author journey or to connect with fellow authors. Whatever it is, find a way to find joy in what it is that you're doing, or you run the risk of burnout or quitting YouTube. And I would say, if you really want to grow on YouTube and you're struggling to break through, look carefully at your content to see how you can improve. Are your videos for you or for your audience? If your videos are made for an audience and to provide value, maybe there's an issue with your video structure. Are your videos too slow or unorganized? Do you meander? Do you meander throughout the video rather than remaining on the topic? Do you need to edit your videos and remove the fluff between sentences? Like, do you not edit your stuff at all? Does your video or your audio straight up suck and the audience cannot hear or see you? If you're not sure what you can do to improve, ask other YouTubers for help, peers specifically. That way you can connect with folks in the same space and try to grow together. But when in doubt, definitely educate yourself. Check out Think Media, Think Marketing, and other channels. Those are just two of my favorites. And then learn as much as you can on how to succeed. Watch others in the same space as you and study what they are doing well. Do not copy them, for the love of goodness. But think about the principles that work for them and how you can utilize those same principles in your own content.
Right. And what stands out to me here is this idea that knowing our purpose when we get into starting a channel of our own, knowing why that we want to do it, that's really important. And it's something that if you're a listener to this show and you'd like to learn more about trying to sort of find your purpose, whether it is in starting a YouTube channel, starting a podcast, just actually sitting down to write a book, I recommend you check out my interview of Lori Buchanan, who is the author of The Business of Being. We spent almost an entire hour in that episode talking about what it means to develop a mission statement and a vision statement for one's work creatively, and then how that can be paralleled when we want to turn those creative endeavors into a business endeavor. And so having the opportunity to really center yourself, and I know interviewing Lori was tremendously helpful for me in giving me the opportunity to step back and remind myself why it is I do these podcasts, why it is I write. And whenever I'm in doubt, now I have these really nice, clean mission statements, these nice, clean visions for where it is that I want to grow that I can always look at and say, ah, yes, this is where I need to be anchored. I can't allow myself to get all caught up maybe in the numbers right now because it wasn't about the numbers when I started, and I can't allow that to sort of take over. So listeners, that's another opportunity to really get into this topic a bit more if you want to explore that in depth. And one other thing that you touched on there, Meg, that was really interesting is this idea of YouTube and the statistics that it will provide you with to actually have a look at your videos and maybe where listeners, or viewers are dropping off, where they're losing interest, whatever the case might be. And I wonder, Meg, when you are looking at how your videos have performed, what role does some of the reporting that YouTube provides, what role does that play in you evaluating the, we'll call it, success of your content for a particular episode?
Yeah, I think one of the big things that people are going to hate and pick on you for is if you have a long intro. And you'll see a lot of people drop off if you don't get to the thing right away. But at the same time, I think that when the bigger you get, the more crap you got to say at the front of the video. So I think it's a balance of making sure you hook someone right away in the beginning. So usually there's that one or two sentence hook where you're like, in this video, you're going to learn X, Y, Z. And then you're like, coming up. And then you give your little spiel. And then I think it's important to tell your audience what they can expect in the video. So this video is structured into 1, 2, 3. So then that way you're reminding them, hey, stay more engaged, stay more engaged. But if I would see someone drop off, I would look where it was and then I would say, okay, what can I do to keep them more engaged? And it might be a third of the way through the video, 2/3 of the way through the video, but it's usually when I would be talking for a long string of time and nothing comes up on the screen. So you have to basically be constantly, I forget what it's called, but you're kind of like re-engaging their attention span. So you pop up a picture on the screen, you do a little special effect. Like one of the things I like to do in my videos is those silly voices. I personally think they're hysterical. And so I use them, but that is an example of something you could do. Text on the screen, screen overlays, sound effects. I do a lot of fart noises in my videos these days. I don't know why. I think it's just so funny. But do something to constantly re-engage their attention span, because you really only have a couple of seconds to keep, like, to keep someone engaged when they first start the video. And then once you have them, you want to keep them. So I would say, as far as metrics, seeing where people drop off and learning what was the trend was helpful. And I think also, to me, one of the biggest metrics that I study is how many views I get, how quickly. So if you get tons of views in the first 24 hours, that's when YouTube's probably going to pick up your video in their algorithm. If you don't get many views in the first whatever, is it your posting time? Is it how you're promoting it on social media? Did you have a crappy thumbnail that day? Is your title not engaging? So you kind of carefully assess maybe what went wrong by looking at, okay, the views aren't good on this video. why. Because if it's not good in the first 24 hours, that's it. Like, usually it's very rare that you two will pick that video up again later. You just have to try again on the next one. So I would say those are probably the two biggest ones. And the click-through rate, CTR, I forget what it's called. Mm-hmm. And that's basically like, you look at that and you see it. It just means that if someone sees your video on their homepage and their recommended feed, if they saw it, did they click on it? And what was that percent? If they saw it and nobody clicks on it, that's bad. That probably means your thumbnail is not engaging. It's not clear. Your title isn't clear or engaging. And then also maybe like your keywords are not at the front of your title. So I think those are probably the three biggest things that I look at. There are way more metrics than that. It can get really overwhelming. So I don't necessarily go too deep into the other stuff.
And for listeners who might not be as familiar with YouTube, Meg, what is it that you mean by thumbnail?
Oh, yeah, sure. When you are on YouTube and you just pull up, let's say, someone's channel, you go to youtube.com/iWriterly, you will see a bunch of videos, and there's usually a frozen picture on the video. And if it looks silly and someone's like halfway through talking and they're like, they probably didn't create that thumbnail. They probably created one of the ones auto-generated by the video on YouTube, which is not cute. Instead, usually you take a picture, a still of yourself, and then you do a bunch of stuff and create a thumbnail, and you have big words on it, like how to write a book, what publishing company should you use. I'm doing a video right now, so it's top of mind. How to write good sex scenes. And so you think about like what text that you can put up on the video that's really engaging, bright colors, and it needs to be easily readable and as few words as possible. So when you say thumbnail, it's the image that's like on top of the video that is almost like a secondary title.
You know, I always did get a kick out of uploading a video and waiting for those automatically generated thumbnails to show up before publishing a book, just to see how many of the three that YouTube gives you to play with by default are incredibly awkward expressions, you know, that you have on your face. And it's always either a sad moment or a funny moment, but there is that reminder that, folks, custom thumbnails, they're available for a reason, and with good reason, because as Meg has explained, thumbnails are a really big driver of getting folks to your video if you do happen to show up on someone's homepage or as a playing next. So don't sleep on those thumbnails. There's a sentence I never thought I would say out loud.
That's really funny, but it's true. I mean, and it's super easy before you record or after you record, stop and either smile for your camera and take the still from your camera or make a face or whatever it is you're doing for the picture, or use like your phone and take a picture of yourself and use that as part of your thumbnail. It's so, so easy. Don't just pick whatever YouTube offers because it looks terrible.
And another time saver that you can use for whether it's thumbnails on something like YouTube videos, or if you just want to have these available for other kinds of content online, is to schedule a photo shoot for yourself, even if it is just you with your camera. I actually did this for the RightsCast Network at one point. I was like, all right, I filmed some videos and some other content for a different project earlier that day. The green screen was already set up, and I was like, well, time to throw on my RightsCast Network t-shirt and just get a bunch of pictures, and I will edit them later. And that way, when I want to include myself gesturing at some words or making a funny face in a photo or on YouTube, whatever the case is, well, I now have this little bank of built up photos that I can just use whenever I want. And I don't need to think about, oh, you know what? I really should have shaved my beard today. And now I can't take a picture because I look like someone who hasn't seen the light of day in 8 weeks. Well, now I don't have to worry about it because I'm sitting on all these photos in the little bank, like I said. And one other thing, Meg, that I do want to let listeners in on that you talked about a little earlier is this sort of video structure. You have all of this content that you need to say at the top of the episode. And listeners, you might have noticed that I do the same thing here. So I know the expression is to pay no attention to the man behind the curtain, but let's pay attention to the man behind the curtain for a second, and I'll let you in on the secret. You'll notice at the top of these episodes, well, I introduce the guest, I say what it is we're going to talk about, then that's the hook. We transition away from that. We spend 10, 15 minutes talking about another topic that's relevant to the interview before we get into the interview that was promised. And then there it is. We've come full circle. So getting that hook in early on and letting people know what your content is going to be about, and like Meg has said, giving benchmarks along the way to remind people where we are in a conversation, incredibly effective stuff that I think you'll also see bleeding in from the world of writing, say, nonfiction, because you want to lay out what your thesis is going to be. We're getting too deep maybe into parallels, but I'm loving it this morning. That's just where the coffee has guided me. So I guess that's what we get.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I would say, though, that the structure of YouTube videos is going to obviously depend on niche, but also is different than podcasts. So I think keep in mind that each medium has a different expected structure. I would say podcasts, the audience allows you to meander a little bit more. You have a little bit more grace than you do on YouTube. People are extremely impatient on YouTube. So I would say just a general structure for those wanting to start on YouTube, have the hook in the beginning, 5 to 10 seconds. Do your little intro if you have one. Usually it's like some type of branded thing. For me, it's that little cartoon of myself that says I write early and it's got the bookshelf in the background. And then I go into an introduction. Hey, I'm this person. This is my experience. And this video, we're going to talk about X. Usually I recommend it, and YouTubers recommend it too, but to do a call to action. So subscribe, hit the like button. These are things that YouTube likes to see in their algorithm. So you want to remind people to do it at the beginning of the video, because they might not make it to the end of the video when people usually ask at the end. So you do a call to action in the beginning. Any other extra stuff? So it might be, if you have a sponsorship, you do the sponsorship in the beginning. If you have an announcement, like I have a pre-order giveaway, I announce that in the beginning, and then you get into the heart of the content. What for the content, if it's a longer video, tell the listeners, the viewers, whoever, what they can expect. Oh, this is going to be broken down to 3 parts. We're going to talk about these 3 things. And then at the end of the content, do another call to action. You can do something like subscribe and hit the like button. You could say subscribe to my newsletter. You could say support me at Patreon. You could say pre-order my book, whatever it is. And then at the very end, there's usually like an outro screen where there's like some image that lasts for 20 seconds or so. And then that's when you see like the up next, watch this. And that's kind of a general structure for a lot of AuthorTube, BookTube videos.
And I'm really glad that you pointed out this important distinction that the audience or the folks who are going to be on YouTube and engaging with that content are perhaps different, generally speaking, than those who might be listening to a podcast, and that patience and the attention span is very different. You know, when I say here on the RightsCast Network, well, we're going to get 10 to 15 minutes of other content before we get into the interview. Well, that's kind of like a radio show, right? And the folks who are tuning in perhaps to a podcast, well, they're used to expecting that kind of thing. If they know it's going to be an hour long episode, no matter what, you know what you're getting into. But on YouTube, yes, as I learned, much to my shame, people don't have the same patience. And so, Meg, you have affirmed that for me today, and it's important, I'm sure, that listeners keep that in mind when they branch out into or continue to develop their YouTube channel as well. And we did, Meg, today have a question for you from a listener over on Instagram. This came from @thewritingscene on Instagram, and they are wondering this: what is the best way to leverage my YouTube channel during a debut book launch? What have you learned, Meg, as you launched The Cyborg Tinkerer?
Absolutely. Just for a little bit of context for those listening, The Cyborg Tinkerer is my debut novel. It's an adult space opera steampunk mashup, and it comes out November 17th, 2020. And I've basically been promoting it pretty heavily since June of 2020. So I have a pre-order from June to November. Anyways, so I think YouTube is a great place to market your books. And I will say the one tough thing about being on AuthorTube versus BookTube, these are two different niches on YouTube, is that you create an audience of writers versus readers. So it's not a one-to-one connection, and you're not necessarily, like for me, I'm not guaranteed to have readers of adult science fiction watching my videos. They might like other things like contemporary romance, young adult thrillers, whatever. So many authors are readers, but they're not necessarily readers of the genre and age category that you write. But regardless, I think it's great to make book-themed videos, but intermix those with your regular content. Don't just make book content like book promo about the book, your debut novel that's coming out, because you may lose your audience. Examples of this are like book trailers, character reveal videos, making calls for ARC reviewers or a street team, and so forth. So definitely do those things, but don't just do those things and make zero other content on your YouTube channel. People are not going to come to hear about your book if they don't care about you first. It's harsh, but it's true. You could also host a giveaway, which is something that I've done for The Cyborg Tinkerer. If you pre-order a copy and fill out the pre-order giveaway form, which is something that I created on Google Docs, you can do this totally for free, you are entered to win one of a bunch of prizes. And I basically have prizes every week of the pre-order leading up to the November launch. And so that is a passive way to remind people, pre-order the book, you'll get a prize, pre-order a book. And pre-order prizes are great because when someone pre-orders a book, they don't have the immediate gratification of getting the book right away. So something like a giveaway gives the reader an immediate gratification while they wait for the book to come out. And you don't have to get all of the prizes. You can ask author friends if they'd like to donate a copy of their book, paperback, ebook, whatever. You can also leverage YouTube to do collabs with other authors in your genre. That way you're sharing audiences. And you could make it like content marketing. It doesn't have to be about, let's talk about each other's books. It can be how to write science fiction or whatever genre it is that you write. And last, you could increase your content leading up to a book launch on YouTube. Maybe usually you post weekly videos, which is what I recommend, at least post once a week. Then the month of book launch, you could post two videos a week, or the week your book launches, you could do daily videos. So there's lots of strategies that you can do, but do not forget to provide the audience what they came there for, not just spamming them with stuff about your book.
This episode of the R.R. Campbell WritesCast is brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing. Dandelion Web Marketing helps writers like you build a thriving author platform through strategic web marketing. If you're not sure if you're on the right track with your website, one of Dandelion Web Marketing's author website audits can help you find out. And right now, listeners to the WritesCast Network can take 50% off one of these audits, which will look at your site's content, security, design, search engine optimization, and more. And it'll provide you with insight into what you might do to better connect with your audience. So to learn the strengths and weaknesses of your current website and take 50% off along the way, visit dandelionwebmarketing.com/WritesCast to learn more. That's dandelionwebmarketing.com/WritesCast.
It's all about finding a balance, and I think too about making sure that your campaign, whatever it's going to be, is sustained. Because like you say, Meg, you started with pre-orders in June. The book is not out for another couple of months as of the date of release of this episode. So you didn't wait until 4 weeks out from the book release to start really making this push. We have a really concerted 6-month campaign almost here where we are making sure that it is just staying in people's minds and that you're offering something along the way to, like you say, engage them beyond driving the pre-orders. It's making sure that it stays top of mind so that when the book comes out, folks who maybe did not place a pre-order are suddenly going, oh, that's right. The book is out now. I've been hearing about this for 6 months. What great buzz there has been. And then they can make that final crossing of the threshold there to getting that book in their hands.
Yeah. And I think there's this principle in marketing, I believe it's called the marketing funnel. You can't just tell someone about your book once and then expect them to purchase it. A lot of times you have to bring them into the funnel. If you want to look at the funnel, go Google it. I don't remember all the funnel steps, but essentially you have to show someone you're the product around 7 times before they're interested in buying it. And it could be many more times than that. So you have to be constantly doing those gentle reminders, plug it in at a time where it's relevant, but you can't just talk about a book once on the day it's released. No one's going to buy it.
And another episode that listeners might tune into if they want to learn more about the sales funnel or marketing channels, what have you, would be episode, I believe it is number 78 with Dan Blank, who joined me for a conversation that was really about taking a human-centered marketing approach. Because I think that as content creators, Meg, people like you and I often have to think about, well, what comes next? What can I put out there for people to engage with? And because we are, in my experience anyway, focused on the content creation side, we can sometimes lose sight of the people, the individuals with whom we need to connect. And I think in the interview that I did with Dan, he did a really great job of breaking down these funnels, not from the standpoint of what we must do insofar as, say, a checklist is concerned, but rather what we ought to consider to actually connect one-to-one with the people who are in our audience, whether that's across YouTube, whether it's on Twitter, whether it is through a podcast or our newsletter, whatever the case is, when we can engage one-on-one with someone, that really has an impact. So that by the time the 7th, quote-unquote, asterisk time comes around that they have engaged with us in our content, they are more than ready to actually take the step to do something like make a purchase or follow up on whatever your call to action might be. So if you do want to do a really deep dive into that, Dan is a really great person to listen to. Again, that's episode number 78. And if you love that episode, as much as I love talking to him, Dan actually has some really great coaching services for all of that stuff as well. And I promise you, Dan isn't paying me to say any of this. So, you know, take that for what it's worth, I guess. But Meg, very good. You did have an opportunity here to kind of mention the cyborg tinkerer. And we do have a couple of minutes left here before we have to draw this interview to a close. So if you'd like, Meg, why don't you share with listeners a little bit more about the cyborg tinkerer? What is it all about? And remind us again when it's going to be released.
Yes, absolutely. I'm terrible at pitching my own work, so let's see how this goes.
Let's do it.
Yeah, so the Cyborg Tinker is an adult space opera steampunk mashup with a pretty heavy romantic subplot. If you don't like steamy sex scenes, you're probably not going to like this book. Fair warning, it's not for the young eyes. But I would say as far as concept, it is, I'm just going to read the pitch because it's easier. A circus competition, a tinkerer tasked with removing the losing cyborg's implants. Who is she to protect when she falls for both the handsome ringleader and a beautiful acrobat? As you might be able to tell from that quick pitch, there is a protagonist and she falls for two different people. It's an own voices novel because my protagonist is bisexual. And basically, it's a steampunk circus competition book. And this person comes on as a cyborg tinkerer for a circus right as a deadly competition starts. And she falls for someone that's participating in the competition and the person that's helping to run it. And they go on a lot of adventures and there's all these sorts of things. So if you like competition books and you like a heavy romantic subplot set in space with a bunch of steampunk tech, Cyborg Tinkerer comes out November 17th, 2020.
That sounds really great. You know, I actually had the opportunity to read The Night Circus by Aaron Morgenstern this year, and I'm getting a little bit of a, you know, night circus-y kind of vibe with the competition surrounding folks, though of course the night circus is not, does not share a setting with the cyborg tinkerer, but I loved the night circus. So you've got me, I'm glad I asked you to elaborate on the cyborg tinkerer because this is, you've got me taking another step through that sales funnel here, Meg.
Hey, so happy to have, so confetti, it's interesting.
confetti is falling, folks. You can't see it. None of us can really see it, but we're going to pretend there is confetti falling right now. So Meg, thank you for sharing a little bit more about the Cyborg Tinkerer there. But before we let you go, where can listeners find you and your work online?
Yes, absolutely. So for social media, I'm on YouTube. Obviously, we talked about YouTube this whole time at iWriterly. And then I'm on Instagram at Meg_Latour. That's LATORRE. And then Twitter at Meg Latour. If you want to get exclusive insiders about YouTube or my books, I also have a Patreon page, which is patreon.com/iWriterly. And then to learn about my novel, to sign up for my newsletter, to hear about courses I'm teaching and all that good stuff, visit my website, iWriterly.com.
Well, there you have it. The author is Meg Latour. The book is The Cyborg Tinkerer. And I want to thank you again, Meg, for joining me for this episode of the R.R. Campbell Rightscast here on the Rightscast Network.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure.
That's all for my conversation with Meg Latour, the founder of iWriterly. Thanks to Meg for joining us, and thanks to you, dear listeners, for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could leave the Rightscast Network a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. This will help the Rightscast Network reach more writers like you, and building that sense of community is what we, and I hope you, are all about. To those of you who have already left us a rating and review, thank you. I'd also like to thank the Rightscast Network's patrons who contribute to our programming financially at patreon.com/rightscast. In exchange for their support, Rightscast Network patrons get access to some great patron perks, including Rightscast swag like stickers, t-shirts, and mugs, discounts on my editing services, and entries in monthly drawings for partial manuscript critiques performed by yours truly. If this sounds like something you'd be interested in, you can join patrons like Laura Hazen and Angeline Boley today in supporting our programming directly at $1, $2, or $3 per episode or per month. Any level of contribution will get you access to some of those great patron perks, so become a supporter now by making your pledge at patreon.com/rightscast. That's patreon.com/rightscast. Thanks as well to our on-air sponsors Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company. To learn more about them or our other sponsors, you can visit rightscast.net/sponsors. We're also grateful for audio support from Electronauts, Inc. To learn more about their audio production and maintenance services, visit electronautsinc.com. That's electronautsinc.com. Coming up next on the Rightscast Network is a Novel Approaches episode featuring yours truly and Maggie Derrick.
For that episode, we'll be discussing either dialogue or anti-heroes, depending on which topic you've chosen in our online poll. To confirm the episode topic before this one debuts on September 11th, visit rightscast.net. And in the meantime, you can say hello on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at RightsCast or by searching for the RightsCast Network. We're also available by email at rightscast@gmail.com, and you can now call us at area code 608-284-8342, where you can leave a voicemail with questions for future guests or other matters you'd like us to address in our programming. Again, that number is 608-284-8342. To reach me personally, you can visit rrcampbellwrites.com or holler at me on Twitter as @IamRRCampbell. I love hearing from listeners of all backgrounds, so please don't hesitate to reach out. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this is R.R. Campbell signing off. Write on and write well.
This is the RightsCast Network, brought to you by Dandelion Web Marketing, Lost Lake Press, and Kill Your Darlings Candle Company, and always streaming at rightscast.net.